You are listening to 90.7 KBOO Portland.
Worry, I won't hurt you. I only want you to have some hope.
Dearly beloved, yes, come ride and dance with Diablo all around Portland as we celebrate Prince's birthday on Wednesday, June 7th at 8 p.m. with a mobile bicycle dance party. We'll be rocking Petalpalooza, dropping the Prince jams all night long, frequent dance stops. Once again, that's Prince's birthday celebration on Wednesday, June 7th, 8 p.m. More information on the KBOO website under Community Events.
Coming to the radio airwaves on Monday, June 5th at 11 p.m. The Ubu Hour Radio Western, Kill Faster Pussycat.
I don't care for the way you girls get your thrills. Enough is enough. Now give it back or I'll... Ugh.
Go, Tommy! Get her! Get her, Tommy! Hit her hard!
Adapted from Russ Meyer's 1965 cult film classic, Faster Pussycat Kill Kill.
Did you see that? That was too easy.
Monday, June 5th.
They're murderers! She killed them with her bare hands!
Kill Faster Pussycat. 11 p.m. on the Ubu Hour.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this June 5th Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviews Tom Athanasiou of the Earth Island Institute on Trump's decision to pull out of the Paris Climate Change Accord. Could something good actually come out of this? They will discuss. Patsy Kohlberg interviews poet and activist Judith Arcana about her new collection of poetry, Announcements from the Planetarium. They will take up the question of poetry in relationship to truth and politics. And I will talk with Jan Hawken. We will take a look at how to understand the impulses behind right-wing white supremacist attitudes and violent actions as related to questions of mental health. We're looking at, of course, the most recent incidents, the killings on the MAX train by Jeffrey Joseph Christian, I believe. I didn't write his name down. I believe that's correct. But we'll explore that in depth around mental health and the questions of, you know, how to understand this and what do we ask for in terms of public safety. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting KBOO and programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill and Tom.
Thanks, Denise. Tom Athanasiou, welcome to KBOO. It's in Portland, Oregon. No city on earth better in promoting itself as green.
Hi, Bill. It's Tom. Glad to be here. Love Oregon. I just went on a trip along the coast.
Oh, yes. Well, the coast still looks good, actually. It's primarily undeveloped. Most unbelievable when you come from California, I suppose. But, you know, Portland and Oregon promote itself as green, and its performance, especially on climate change, is extremely timid to say the best, mostly hot air. But Tom, welcome again. Let me give a little introduction to you, and then we can start the interview. Tom Athanasio founded and directs Eco Equity, whose principal goal is justice for the poor within an emergency global climate mobilization, which he hopes to live and see. He speaks and writes and consults a lot, including the book Divided Planet, The Ecology of Rich and Poor. Tom, you were in Paris a couple years ago at the signing of the Accords. You wrote about it. Then you had a minority opinion on the left. You acknowledged the Accords were quite insufficient, but you contended they did represent something that could lead to much more. That assessment has recently gotten more support. So, Tom, tell us about the Accords, what happened, why you remain convinced that we can save the planet, even after the self-described smartest man in the world, Donald Trump, he withdrew from the U.S. from the Accord.
Okay, Bill. Well, first of all, I wasn't just in Paris. I've been attending the climate negotiations for, I hate to say this, but 17 years, which is a really long time. In particular, I have been organizing within the international civil society movement on the equity question. Part of equity when it comes to climate is ambition itself. I mean, you cannot make any climate transition fair if it involves the destruction of the climate system, which, you know, differentially hits the poor and the vulnerable and the innocent. So ambition is the key question, even from an equity perspective. And, you know, I was very disappointed with a lot of the left criticism of Paris, because basically it indicated a community of people who didn't understand the negotiations at all. And, you know, it's interesting that once Trump was elected, people kind of, sort of, instantaneously got it. I mean, it was clear once Obama was out and Trump was in that Paris was something that had to be defended, you know. And also when Donald Trump quote unquote withdrew from the Paris agreement, there was a tremendous amount of discussion about Paris and how it actually works or is supposed to work. And I think we're all coming up to speed now and starting to understand that, you know, Paris, for example, couldn't be legally binding precisely because there is no global government. There is no global system of law. And so blah, blah, blah. I don't want to get into the mechanisms of how Paris works and why it was a huge win. Not, you know, a first step, but actually a real first step. I don't want to get into that because we don't really have enough time to drill down into it. But I do want to say that the right always understood how important Paris was. I do want to say that.
Yeah. Tom, my sense is, let's get into Trump and to Trump's withdrawal. Prior to it, during the week of tension and suspense that he created, he's a TV producer, after all, as he told, you know, tomorrow I'm going to make the great announcement or whatever it is, 2 days from now, everybody's watching him, which he loves. But in any event, before that, I was afraid that he was going to stay in. And if he stayed in, as people have pointed out, and Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, acknowledged, a lot of companies argued, we have to stay in order to slow down the process. You know, as long as we're in there and we're the big gorilla in the world, we can keep anything from happening that would really discomfort the fossil fuel industry. Well, Trump apparently just ignored all of those pleas by industry, so many of them, and withdrew. And it seems to me it's a real gift to us, his withdrawing, because he's sort of the buffoon and dunce of the world now, especially in in the media all over the world is every stupid, arrogant pronouncement, vulgar pronouncement, gets front page. Here is, and now he is the spokesperson, the very symbol of climate change denial.
Yeah, no, it's great.
It seems to be good. Yeah,
Trump is. You know, this is also coming up in the you know, there, a lot of people think that we should impeach Trump. I don't think we should impeach Trump. First of all, Pence, who is a truly frightening creature, would be more effective. And second, Trump is our best organizer. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean, really, we haven't got a chance in the United States unless the Republican coalition is radically weakened and delegitimated. And how could that possibly be better than under Donald Trump?
Yeah.
The main thing about Paris is the question that you just raised about the fossil cartel and don't they want the U.S. to stay in? Now, that's a pretty complicated question. And but the thing I want to say is that the fossils are not the only sector of capitalism, right? And that if you want to understand the climate crisis, you have to go up to about 30,000 feet. You have to be willing, at least intermittently, to talk about the structure of the economy as a whole and globally. And you know, I hate to say this, but corporate executives are people too, right? And they probably, at least some of the time, at least on weekends when they're relaxing with a couple of drinks, might want the planet to be inhabitable for their grandchildren. And you know, they can make just as much money with solar power as they can with oil and coal. There's no necessary relationship between the capitalist system and the fossil sector. You know, economic sectors come and go, right? So to stabilize the climate system, we've got to phase out the fossil fuel sector. Now, it's a tremendously powerful sector of the economy, and it includes, you know, massive countries and blocks of the global economy, but it's only one sector among others. And so the question of the powerful and the elite and the divisions within the elite and the relationship between the fossil cartel and the capitalist system, these are all difficult questions. But you know, solar is rising and the fossils are in trouble but not fast enough. Yep. Right? You know, right. You know, we've got to get, we're talking, just to summarize the climate challenge in one sentence, we're talking about the decarbonization of the global economy by about 2050 or 2060. Complete decarbonization of the economy, drawdown of carbon emissions to near zero or net zero. We need international coordination to do that, and you know, Paris is architected to get stronger, but that can only happen if there are successful political movements within every country, especially the United States.
Right. This is Cable Radio 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick talking to Tom Athanasio about the Paris Accords, Trump, and how rapidly we must move towards a decarbonized economy. Tom, I agree. Capitalism can do fine without based in solar and wind energy. In fact, the markets are now, any smart executive, even of the oil companies, in fact, the coal museum in Kentucky, the coal put solar panels on the roof to save money. of course, that's true. It's the market is, in fact, pushing for it because it's so successful. But still, the problem of capitalism remains. exponential growth, you know, as your friend David Suzuki, I guess, made famous, that line, is the creed of the cancer cell. That is, it has to keep growing and growing and growing. So even if we start to solve the climate crisis, the constant growth of this apparatus is going to, in fact, deplete and exhaust other, you know, we are now ruining the land all over the earth. We have to move towards agroecology and a different form of agriculture. It seems to me all of this is related, and I have the sense that the capitalists know it, and they want to stop it as much as they can, as long as they can profit. And I agree that that many capitals are going to move towards solar energy industries. And the capitalists are humans too and would prefer breathing clean air and not having asthmatic kids. Of course, they do because they live in areas that are not as badly impacted. But it seems to me we also have to think about that larger system of capitalism and see it as a threat to, inevitably, to human life.
Bill, this is, that's absolutely true. But you know, this is not academic anymore. This is not long in the future anymore. This is a real strategic imperative that is breathing right down our neck. And I think one of the key things you have to keep in mind when you are thinking strategically is sequencing. What you have to do first, and what you have to do second, and what you have to do third. And the fact of the matter is that the climate clock is ticking so quickly that the process of political and economic change away from capitalism, particularly at the global level, is going to take so long that if we can't describe some sort of pathway that leads to what we used to call the radical reform of the capitalist system, which would have to include a transition from fossil-based capital energy stocks to solar and wind-based energy stocks, you know, a bioremediation on a grand scale. If we can't pull that off, we're not going to be around as a civilization to talk about the transition from capitalism forward.
Yeah, so I agree. Let me, though, state a hypothesis. One of the great things about the new technology is that it seems to me, and particularly in California, how many cities are now and counties and regions are adopting this community choice aggregation, which means a huge increase in local cooperation and in local production of energy. Some larger wind plantations and everything, but localized around and a local grid, you know, confederated in a region and then even further confederated to make it more resilient. But it seems to me it's the local power is so superior to the system that the investor-owned utilities are promoting. That is this big centralized system with a huge, expensive trillion-dollar grid that would take years and years to build. We have sort of an answer which is local and democratic and municipal and regionalized that is so superior and that really challenges the immense power of international capital. Why don't you comment on that hypothesis?
I agree with you that it's a really key tool, particularly in local economies. But, you know, we're also talking right now, about the African Renewable Energy Initiative, which is going to try to put 300 gigawatts of solar up in a distributed and locally controlled fashion throughout the African continent. And we're also talking about the fact that 47 countries within a coalition, a global coalition that formed within the Paris negotiations, have committed themselves to 100% renewable energy economies by the year 2050. So again, if we're talking about Paris, we've got to think globally. And people know about community choice aggregation in towns like Oakland and in towns like Portland, but a lot of people don't know about the African Renewable Energy Initiative, which they don't know about what's going on in solar in India. And these are the kinds of things that we're talking about when we're talking about destabilizing the Paris Accord. You have to remember that, there's only one atmosphere, and this has to be a process of global decarbonization. It has to be fantastically quick, and it has to be one that includes the poor as well as the rich. And it's going to be very, very hard. The question of fairness in such a context becomes an absolutely critical question. Just to loop back to Mr. Trump, I want to remind your listeners that his charge against Paris was that it was unfair to the United States.
That was ridiculous. Tom, thanks a lot. I think I can summarize a little bit with that old saying, think globally, act locally, everywhere and globally. Thanks a lot for talking to us. We'll continue.
Okay, take care of yourself, Bill.
Right, so long.
Spoke of life most free from slavery, with eyes that showed no trace of misery. The phrase in connection first with she, oh girl, that love is just a four-letter word.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO, that's Portland, FM 90.7. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks for all of you who became members or renewed your memberships over our last membership drive. That was at the end of the month. We really appreciate it. And we will, of course, put all of that good hard cash to use, bringing you the fabulous programming that we do every week. Next up, we have Patsy Kohlberg, Patricia Kohlberg, who is both engineering this morning and about to conduct an interview. So I want to give her a shout out for that. And
thank you, Denise.
Yeah. And Fearless.
Oh, Fearless. I don't know about that.
Okay. And she's here with poet and activist Judith Arcana, who I believe is also a KBOO volunteer.
Yes.
All right. Well, welcome to you both, and have at it.
Okay, Judith Arcana is, Arcana, to talk with us about intersections between poetry and politics and to read a little bit of her poetry. Thanks for coming in, Judith. Poetry and politics is a subject on which many have written. James Baldwin famously stated that artists are here to disturb the peace. And West Indian poet Derek Walcott observed that the fate of poetry is to fall in love with the world in spite of history. So here today to reflect on those and other thoughts, we have again Judith Arcana, who writes poems, stories, essays, and books influenced by the times and places of her life. Her work is rooted in her political thinking and most notably a commitment to reproductive justice. Judith hosts a poetry show on KBOO, called Poetry and Everything, on the fourth Monday night of every month at 10 p.m. Judith's new poetry collection, Announcements from the Planetarium, came out in April from Flowstone Press. She'll be reading from her new book at Broadway Books this coming Wednesday, June 7th, at 7 p.m. So to start us off this morning, I am going to read a short excerpt from a poem by William Carlos Williams, which is called Asphodel, that greeny flower. It is difficult to get news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. So Judith, talk to us a little bit about the things that I just read.
Well, All of those guys, of course, are people I've admired for years and years. And the line from Williams is the classic line, or one of the classic lines about the value of poetry. There are, of course, many folks who say, oh, poetry doesn't do anything. And in fact, they quote Auden and cite a poem of his and say, see, even Auden said this, but my okay. attitude is yeah. this. This is one of the frequently brandished proofs that poetry has no such power. They quote the phrase, quote, poetry makes nothing happen, but they don't read the rest of it, which says, after that line, it ends with, poetry survives a way of happening, a mouth. And I love nice. The phrase, a mouth, uh-huh. which is, of course, a complete denial of this other thing, which he's being extremely ironic about, and people...
How dare they misread Auden?
Well, also, I guess, you know, irony... Some people love it. Other people don't even know about it.
There you go.
Really. So I brought with me, because I knew we wanted to talk about these topics, some words that I did write a little while ago in answer to your question, Patsy. This was part of an interview I did last year. I said, I'm quoting myself here, poetry has the capacity to move us, to make us feel and think and act. All over the world, for countless centuries, people have named their babies with poetry, buried their dead with poetry, and marched into battle with the words of poets in their minds or on their lips. And my thinking is, poetry can speak fiercely to and for us. Indeed, it can be so powerful, and this is something a lot of folks in the States don't know about, it can be so powerful that poets have been banished, tortured, imprisoned, and killed for the impact of their work. Now, we're kind of lucky here in the United States yeah. that the people who have the power to banish, torture, imprison, and kill us don't take poetry seriously. So maybe we shouldn't keep pointing out how valuable
yeah,
it
okay.
is.
There we go.
I've thought a lot about this, partly because I know that it's not only not useful, but it's also impossible to separate my political consciousness from the art that I make. And I take great pleasure in reciting. I'm going to quote a couple more. I okay. loved your sites. Here's a couple from the girls' team, heavy hitters, women. Toni Morrison, who said, it seems to me that the best art is political, and you ought to make it irrevocably political and unquestionably beautiful at the same time. And of course, that's the sticking point. We have to not be dogmatic. We have to not be didactic. Those of us who are word artists, we have to be able to include our political positions, opinions, views, attitudes, while we are making beauty.
Well, isn't that the whole thing about poetry, is that it speaks to what I think of as the hindbrain? It kind of, you know, bypasses the intellect and gets into your sort of your subconscious and makes you feel, you know, the beauty and the sadness and the outrage. And
I think you're right, and I think that poetry in that way is a hybrid of sorts. It's words and music, so to speak. There is a lyric presence in poetry. Even the stumpiest of our stuff is a lyric presence, uh-huh. and people are responding in the very way you just described to words on a page, on a screen, spoken in the air, performed. Yeah, absolutely.
And the other thing that's odd is that poetry is thought of as an extremely solitary activity, yet I think it connects us one to the other.
Absolutely, and it began as public performance thousands of years ago. It was part of, can you imagine, I mean, think about even Homer, of course, the classic case, literally classic case. This is a guy, and there were many like him, who wrote and memorized things as long as the Iliad and the Odyssey and so on and so forth, and then performed them for people who were willing to sit and or stand uh-huh. and listen.
Judith is standing at the moment.
And listen to this extraordinary outflow and receive it in the way that you just defined. So yeah, unquestionably, it's about performance as much as it is about words on a screen, words on a page.
All right, let's perform a little of your poetry, because you've got this fabulous poem that I think people will, I think there's a lot to chew on in it. Your poems range across a variety of themes, including ways of knowing, mystery and magic, the wonders of the natural world, growing up in the U.S., and a host of observations on gender and aging. But also, in a time when the very notion of truth is under attack, you've written this poem that takes as its premise the existence of truth. So could you read, please,
for us? Yes. Thanks for asking. I wrote this poem actually some years back, and when I was putting this collection, Announcements from the Planetarium, together, it was one of the ones that I plucked from the past because I saw, whoa, this belongs with these new ones, which is an amazing thing anyway, you know, when, you know, times change.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, yeah,
nice.
Time changes, we change, everything changes all the time, and this became something else, as always happens when you're putting together a collection. It's like quilting. Okay. The first true thing. You're sad to leave the first true thing. The first true thing you know won't stay. It runs like water all down your life, rushes hot behind your heart, slides inside like dreams talking. Deep whispers in your mind will go on telling that true thing. That true thing will go down rocks, into ground, on past deep winter, gone. But you can know it. You can remember. Use it to learn language, for listening, for seeing things when they're really there, yes, and when they're not.
I love that poem.
Thank you.
Yeah. So what do you want to tell us about the poem?
Well, of course, you know, writers, we like to think that we've already said what we have to say when we've written it. And so, but of course, your question is, you know, is appropriate. I think that the way I'm going to talk about the way I feel about it now, partly because, of course, who remembers from years ago what I was thinking in the moment, but also because of this linkage thing that I was speaking of. Because so many of the poems in this collection have to do with growing into an advancing consciousness, that age brings more knowledge and changes, ongoing changes in consciousness. And so here's this piece in which, as you smilingly identified, the notion of truth appeared. In fact, the first true thing, but opens immediately by saying that a person is, must be, ought to be, probably will be sad to leave the first true thing. It's like we get this truth and then we move on. We leave it behind. And then it's moving as if it were going down into the earth, all these...
Except it doesn't really... Well, you go ahead.
Well,
it seems to me that it leaves and it doesn't leave.
Well, exactly. And at the end, I play this little game... seeing things when they're really there, yes, and when they're not. And one of the things I think about that set of lines now is, can it mean that what we see isn't real, or can it mean that we see things that are real even when they're not right in front of us, because we've taken them in along with the first and the second and the third and all the rest of the true things that we've experienced, and they're in us now, which is a way of thinking about this set of lines at the end that I don't think I had a few years back, but came into my head, maybe because of the political context that you addressed when you introduced it.
You mean when you wrote this poem originally, those last two lines weren't there?
No, they were there, but I thought and felt differently about them.
Oh, interesting. So your own poetry spoke to you in a different
way
because of the context.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, and I see that happening all the time, but in particular, as I say, because you focused on this, because truth is under attack, the very idea of truth, And not just from the trumpets, but even, this started, what, in the 70s? Certainly in the 80s, the notion that there could be no truth. This was an academic exercise. The In the colleges and universities and high schools as well. Well, it's all subjective, as if there could not be something that was real that we could identify as truth. And while I certainly understand that we all interact with whatever we see, feel, hear, touch, blah, 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 I am one of the people who thinks that there is stuff that is real and therefore truly in the world with us.
You know, on the other hand, there are a lot of contradictions and ambiguities in this poem. So how do those relate to something you're identifying as truth?
Well, I think one truth is that there are a lot of contradictions and ambiguities.
In truth.
And that we, exactly, and that we cannot allow the fact that real life always contains contradiction and ambiguity to lead us into a denial that what happened didn't actually happened, to deny that someone actually said what they actually said, even if we have recordings of it. Because now, again, as you pointed out initially, despite recordings and or the fact that we know that recordings can be fooled around with, and so suddenly people are, you know, the ground is shifting under us or all around us or we are shifting on it. And I naturally fear and am enraged by, on occasion, the notion that what many of us have perceived as real and or true can be denied because of the fact that in the world there is ambiguity and there is contradiction. These things don't cancel each other out.
Right, which brings me to another thing that I noticed about the poem is that, excuse me, it's a lament.
Oh, wow. I mean, don't you think? That. I love your saying that. Say some more about that.
Well, it has a sadness. I kept coming back to the idea that these things were running like water through your life, that they're running not into your heart or through your heart, but behind your heart.
That's what she says here.
Yes, it is what she says.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, it things leaving in winter and going into rocks, and it just, there was a sadness to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hadn't thought about it that way, but I'm not going to deny it. I'll point out, though, that in the second stanza, you can know it. You can remember, and here's, of course, something dear to my heart as a word woman, use it to learn language for listening, for seeing things. Even with the ironic little twist at the end.
Which is very hopeful.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. I'm a person who actually only learned hope fairly recently. I was, and I guess I still am in some sense, a cynic in my soul. But I learned hope in the last 3-4 years, consciously sought hope and had a great difficulty dealing with it because I always thought, oh, please, let's just live for what's real and not talk about what might come. And my teacher, in the world of hope, hopefulness, and hoping, was the late Grace Paley, who was one of the most hopeful people I ever encountered. And when we talked about it, I would say to her, you know, Grace, I just can't muster it up. I can't find hope. And she would say, oh, honey, you'll see. And she would, you know, give examples and so on.
Yeah. And you know something? On that note, I've got to wrap up. I think our timekeeper fell asleep. we've got to get...
Research.
Okay, as Tom Lehrer would say.
Anyway, I want to just very quickly to say it was lovely to talk with you, and thank you so much for coming in. And for more information, samples of Judith's work, and links to online readings, you can and her interviews, you can go to visit her website at juditharcana.com. And don't forget, Judith will be reading from her new book at Broadway Books on Wednesday, June 7th at 7 p.m. That's at 1714 Northeast Broadway. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Denise Morris for The Old Mole. I'm here with Patricia Kohlberg, our engineer. Thanks to both her and Judith Arcana for that talk on poetry. That's a nice addition to The Old Mole. We needed a little something peppy, I think, or at least inquisitive in not such a dire way. Nice job. Yeah.
Thank you.
We're going to go into dire, however, from here. Yesterday, Sunday, June 4th, the Warriors for Freedom free speech rally occurred downtown at Cherry Shrunk Plaza. This rally occurred under an even darker cloud than it would have otherwise, on the heels of the Max Train murders Memorial Day weekend involving Jeremy Joseph Christian, a known neo-Nazi-minded right-wing guy who had previous run-ins with the police and was known to be very agitated and violent towards left and liberal protesters who were often counter-protesting some of these other free speech rallies. I had an opportunity to talk with Old Mole Jan Hocken, who did attend the rally, but her insights in terms of psychology and mental health are what's important here for us in terms of how we understand the impulses behind right-wing white supremacist attitudes and violent actions as they do relate to questions of mental health. And we'll go to that interview now.
Jan, Friday before Memorial Day weekend, the city of Portland was hit with a really horrible event that occurred on the Max trains, where three men who had intervened in a situation where Jeremy Joseph Christian, now arrested for their murder, intervened to protect two young women who were on the other end of his racist and xenophobic diatribe. Jeremy Joseph Christian was arrested. He's not an unknown entity in Portland for activists and for police both. Through reading, we discovered that he was understood to have mental health issues. He was showing up at a number of events, particularly the event sponsored by right-wing and Trump-supporting groups, the Free Speech Rally that they had. He showed up to that event carrying a baseball bat, which was removed by the police. And the police were quoted as saying, you know, this is a man who we believe had a head trauma, a head injury, and mentally ill. So the narrative surrounding Jeremy Joseph Christian, of course, is about his mental health. And you, as a mental health professional for so long, both in the clinical setting and teaching at Portland State, and you're also an activist, you have plenty of thoughts about how these narratives play out, how they interact with the political landscape, and also what impact these sorts of things have on activists in their lives.
Well, often when a psychiatric diagnosis, or what's more euphemistically called mental health issues, which of course we all have to one degree or another, but that's meant to be less stigmatizing.
Right. And there's a lot to be a crazy about right now.
Right. Yeah. So we all have mental health issues, including many of the people who run this country. The question of whether a psychiatric diagnosis is a useful way of understanding the situation is, I mean, it depends on how it's introduced. On one level, bringing in a psychiatric diagnosis or understanding someone who does terrible things as having mental health issues is a way of arguing against a kind of willful badness. And often mental health interpretations have been associated with a more progressive outlook, that people often do things for reasons not under their own control, and they're driven by tormenting voices. And the point that is often used in the criminal justice system, that people just willfully disobey the governing rules of society, it is a false notion of self-determination. So on the one hand, there is something always important to see people caught in these dramas, even when they do bad things or destructive things or harmful things, as in a way acting out some of their own internal torment. And I suspect that was the case here, that this was probably someone who may have been struggling with tormenting voices, the general psychiatric explanation, if he was psychotic and paranoid, would be it's a way of finding a target, an external target, for something unbearable, the unbearable noise in your own head. And sometimes that is part of a very self-destructive pattern of attacking yourself, stabbing yourself. There are many people who suffer from a psychotic disorder who harm themselves much more than others. But occasionally, you know, sometimes this gets acted out where groups that are identified as the threat become the target. Now, it's also important to recognize, though, that conservatives are very interested in dusting off the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, you know, the Manual of Disorders, when it suits their purpose. And that rather than providing services for homeless people, helping people who are very fragile emotionally, who are burdened by tortured voices, and have psyches that are very vulnerable to a lot of noise, and there are many people on the streets who do suffer from feeling like they're falling apart and their lives are falling apart. So rather than help those people, the attribution of a psychiatric disorder or mental health issues often is invoked to individualize the behavior, that this is just one crazy person. And similarly with the Orlando shooting massacre a year ago this month, where 40-some people were murdered and 50 people wounded by someone who came into a Latin gay club and massacred people. And so there was all this discussion, is this guy mentally ill? And yes, of course, but then the question is, well, how is the larger society implicated in this madness? What other madness is on the stage here? Here we have murder of these men on the who rose to protect these two women being harassed by this guy on the Max line. It was a heroic act rather than passive bystanders or people turning away. These were men who stepped in and did try to de-escalate the situation. This also, by the way, is a pretty unusual situation. And there are so many cases where someone is crazy or attacking people and others step in to de-escalate, to protect the victims, which is what you do. You pull back and you move toward protecting whoever's being victimized and try to speak calmly and appeal or connect with the humanity of the person. And so one risk of a situation like this is people become afraid of intervening. Actually, these men did a very good job, from what I can tell, of trying to de-escalate the situation. But there were other things going on with this guy that were apparently very difficult to control.
And as I said, he was more a known entity to activists in Portland who had been in counter-protests to many of the gatherings that have taken place around the city, in which right-wing, fascist-oriented groups are coming together to protest and be public in their own right. And in what way are these groups accountable? Because it is always easy to characterize that person as the lone wolf or just the crazy mm-hmm. person. We're not like that.
So we might use this frequently invoked notion of the bystander, that we all have a moral obligation to intervene, to step in, and it's become common wisdom. But it's not always so clear how and what that means. And there are a couple points, I think, that are important in relation to this issue you raised. It makes me uncomfortable when people progressives argue, because he was known to the police, because he was known to be a troublemaker, something should have been done about this guy earlier. He should have been arrested. He should have been identified as dangerous. There actually has been a movement within the mental health field of many over since the 60s that make it harder to arrest someone who's menacing unless they've done something. In our worry about people like this, we shouldn't sacrifice the restrictions on putting someone on a psychiatric hold, arresting someone on a mental health evaluation because you think they are bothering people because they're loud. And once someone has crossed that and actually threatened someone, it's a different issue. But I think we do have to be careful about what we call for. Like, what do we call, who do we call a terrorist? And domestic terrorism, or calling on the police should have done something. Well, maybe not. I mean, that can also have enormous consequences, relying on the police or the FBI to do that kind of work.
Because the police have done things in the past, in fact, killing multiple people in the city who are having mental health issues,
right,
and around the country.
Right. And and people being seen as psychiatric unstable, who are activists. And so these are hard-fought rights to restrict what you can do when someone's behavior is upsetting you. And you, there was a period of time, if someone in your family, their behavior upset you, if it was especially a woman or a child, you could have them hospitalized against their will and for very long periods of time. But I think the other issue you're raising is more one of how do we think about a good society that equips people to intervene in certain situations, but also what sets people off who are vulnerable to this kind of threat and feeling the world is closing in on them. And one worry, of course, with the Trump administration and all of this rhetoric and the more of a kind of muscular hard right taking over many communities or trying to find their legitimacy, especially in small towns. I mean, here in Portland today, that they're not a dominant force, but they are a scary presence in many rural communities. And people who are vulnerable to the ambient noise in the world around them can act this stuff out. And people who are paranoid, is interesting, in the 1950s, the most common delusional system for someone diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic was that the CIA was controlling their thoughts as a way of trying to get at the communists. And there was a preoccupation with communists and the CIA implanting things in their brain, thinking they're, you know, there was a lot about the Red Scare was really central to delusional systems. And now there's much more of this theme of the Arabs, or I mean, especially Arab Americans, Muslims, start becoming the focus of this kind of ambient fear. And I think we have a responsibility to kind of quiet the noise on our side, too. How do you speak back to that in a way that also is more thoughtful and doesn't just contribute to a lot of loud noise of, you know, they're evil, we're good, they're evil, we're good, which is also a characteristic of people with, quote, mental health issues, dividing the world into very simple righteous, wicked distinctions. The counter demonstration was at Chapman Park, which was right by Terry Schrunk Plaza, but it was the area where the Occupy movement was centrally based, and it kind of evoked the memory and spirit of that. And I think many people down there were part of that Occupy movement. And today, again, it was for the afternoon, but there was this sense of reclaiming public space, that these men were murdered in public train, the MAX line, and someone from the Amalgamated Transit Union was there. It's where other representatives of other labor unions talking about these are public goods, our parks, our mm-hmm. trains, our buses, mm-hmm. and that we cannot be afraid to ride on our buses and trains, and that belongs to all of us. So the sense of understanding the symbolism that these reactionaries do pick public spaces because those are places where people gather, and often places of diversity, like the Orlando massacre was at a gay club. And these are represent places where people come together to have pleasure, to have enjoyment, to have picnics, to dance, to have fun. And if you attack those places where people of diverse backgrounds gather, you really attacked something vital symbolically. So we have to also reclaim those places symbolically and in actuality.
All right. Well, thank you, Jan, for joining me. For The Old Mole, this is Denise Morris and Jan Hocken.
This is Denise Morris back live. I'm here with Bill Resnick, who also attended the rally yesterday, the counter-protest, and has some comments on that. Some insights, Bill?
Some observations.
Observations.
Yes, Denise, nobody could be everywhere all the time. It was enormously interesting and heartening, the turnout. Ours was enormous comparison to the alt-right and the Trump supporters. They had maybe 200 to 300 people. We had thousands. They looked a little bigger because we had so many rubberneckers who went into their place, or people talking to them. A few people went in. Maybe we'll have a report next week on the conversations with them.
Yeah, we did have a mole in an old mole being a mole. Yes, so there's a possibility for that. Yeah.
Yes, anyway, but we really outnumbered them. And the chanting and the singing that we did from all around the park, actually, a lot of noise from the black block, but really not much chanting or singing. But the labor people and us people who were part of the Stand Against, Portland Stands Against Hatred group, there's a tremendous amount of chanting and singing. The roar of it, they had their free speech. They could hear themselves talking, but it was within an envelope of sound of disapproval. And that can be very humiliating and demoralizing for them. And I suspect a lot of them wouldn't come back for the next one. It was probably sort of unpleasant for them to be there, even though they put on a brave face. It was also interesting, though, what they were claiming, which was, we aren't racist. It's these other people are racist. They had this big sign of dominated the thing. The BLM is, and I thought, why are they against the Bureau of Land Management? And then I said, oh, it's those occupiers. They came down here. No, it was Black Lives Matter. They're in the smaller print. They're the real racists. It looks as if this alt-right has adopted this notion that the real racists are these poor people who they blame for everything in America. Corporate power is never mentioned by them. Only poor people ripping off the system and causing the bank crisis. In any event, there's a lot to be said. We'll say even more next week. Many of the alt-right people, though, and the Trump supporters can be talked to. And that's what's interesting. They are not a homogeneous Nazi group. They're very complicated and vulnerable to, in fact, moving towards support for Bernie, for example.
Right.
Johanna Brenner had a really interesting talk.
Yeah, and Johanna is an honorary mole, was a mole, and still very active in the community. And I'll just give a portion of this with her permission. She is outlining, I think, the broader sense that we need to be working with in order to get real social justice and real change. We stand united against hate and bigotry and honor the brave men who gave their lives for values that we cherish: solidarity and cooperation, respect and dignity for all. I suggest that we also stand for an economy, a government, and a society that operates according to those same values: solidarity, cooperation, and respect. And of course, goes on to talk about, you know, what we need: healthcare, good jobs, safe jobs, clean air, all of it. So we are going to wrap up here for the Old Mole. Locus Focus is on next, and that's Barbara Bernstein. We have Health Watch at 11, Dr. David Damon Tweedy, I'm sorry, and Madness Radio at 11:30. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host. Patricia Kohlberg has been our engineer.
Good morning. You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, and it is just now turning 10 o'clock. At Health Watch today on the Boo at 11 o'clock, their Health Watch speaks to Dr. Damon Tweedy about his book, Black Men in a White Coat, which examines the complex ways in which both black doctors and patients must navigate the terrain of race and medicine. And at 11:30, Madness Radio looks at human rights in India and how the legacy of colonialism has affected mental health. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. And now stay tuned for a special one-hour Locus Focus, which presents the premiere of Barbara Bernstein's latest documentary, Sacrifice Zones, the story about the pressure to transform a region of iconic landscapes and environmental stewardship into a global center for shipping fossil fuels.
Coming to the radio airwaves on Monday, June 5th at 11 p.m.